two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. This is where we'd say aloha. You know why? It means hello and goodbye.
And goodbye.
Yeah. And you just got back from beautiful Hawaii.
I sure did. It was a lot of fun.
What does a doctor, a psychologist, do on vacation?
So we went to Maui and we sort of split it up between adventures and just relaxing. Ashley loves to just relax, but she was a good sport and had a lot of fun with me on some adventures. We saw a ton of whales. Now, this is their birthing time.
Okay.
So there were a lot of whales and their babies out there. We went on a boat, so that was pretty fun. Hiked to the top of the volcano. That was cool.
Now, if I remember correctly, when you're on vacation, that's when you catch up on TV. You like to just to sit in the hotel room.
I usually do.
And watch like the home decorating
shows.
But
we didn't this time.
Okay.
No, we didn't spend much time in the hotel at all. We were out on the beach or we rented a Jeep and drove all around the island and we had a great time.
Did you get some malasados?
No, what's that?
Oh, it's a fried donut.
Oh, malasados. Okay, yeah. I miss those.
Oh, yeah, it's really
I definitely
good.
Ate a lot of stuff that was delicious and not good for me, but I miss those.
You know what? They don't drink a lot of milk in Hawaii because it's so expensive. It's like $9
a
gallon.
I didn't really
see
it around much, but I'm not a big milk drinker.
You know, the thing I loved about Hawaii, because I've been there a couple of times with my family, is that nobody's in a hurry. In Hawaii, like
this island time.
Yeah, just go ahead of us. We're fine. We're in the States. Everybody's trying to get out of the parking lot first. In Hawaii, just go ahead. We're cool.
I love that. Yeah, no, it was a nice change of pace.
While you were living up the good life in Hawaii, I was doing something that some people would think was kind of dangerous. But maybe not. I was DJing a party for Budweiser.
That sounds borderline, yeah.
And I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Yeah.
But it was a retirement party for somebody who was a higher up in Budweiser.
Okay. Because they have a big distributing plant up in Ogden.
Yep,
right?
And they've got them all over the state. But these guys have been family friends of mine since I was a little kid. And I worked for them during summers off of college, and my little brother still works for them.
I didn't know you worked there too.
Oh yeah, just it was my summer job.
Okay,
and so I would be the guy that would help people take kegs into bars, deliver cases to convenience stores, or as they call them, C stores.
The C stores.
Yeah, they're called C stores.
Casey stores.
No, convenience.
Oh, convenience stores.
Yeah, the C stores. So you'd either get on that day put on the C store run, or the keg route, or the grocery stores.
The whole picture's coming in a little clearer.
Yeah. And then you'd be tasked with rotating beer, so you could get the born on date earlier and that kind of stuff, but I'm digressing. But it was a party for the higher up at Wasatch Distributing, and they said, "Hey, would you mind DJing?" And I was like, "No, I'd be honored." As a matter of fact, and while I'm up there DJing, a couple people would come up and was like, "Is this tough? Is this hard?" And I go, "DJing?" And they're like, "No,
you weren't doing a very good job that night."
Well, this one lady, and this is a crazy story. She comes up to me and she goes, "Hey, we're going to have an intervention." And I'm like, "Oh, you heard my podcast. Who would need some help? Where are we going?" They go, "No, can you get some better music on?" I was like, ouch.
Like, too much MC Hammer.
Yeah, but I was like, you got to read the room. You know what I mean? There's some older people here. There's some younger people. You got to find that sweet spot.
Yeah. What was the demographic sweet spot? Bee Gees?
Bee Gees, Steve Miller Band.
Oh, love the Steve
Little
Miller
CCR.
Band. Yeah,
you know what I mean?
All right.
That just seems to
appease. That's 60s, people in retirement age.
Yeah, appeases everybody. But they got me thinking, it was like, in all reality, it's not hard for me to be around alcohol. And some people will be like, well, aren't you mad at Budweiser? They ruined your life. And I was like, well, technically Budweiser didn't ruin my life. I ruined my life.
Right.
You know what I mean?
If that was the attitude you were holding on to, that would be kind of dangerous in your sobriety, I think, if you were blaming the beer or the beer companies.
Yeah. And that's the one thing that really helped me out in my recovery is when I got sober and process stuff in recovery and looked back about all my decisions. And, you know, there were some outside forces and there was most of it just me. I mean, I was the one constant in everything.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was like I was the one constant. So, and I believe in recovery. You've got to take ownership. That way that you own your faults and you can own your successes. And
any behavior change starts with owning your part of it.
So I don't have a problem DJing parties where alcohol is involved. I don't have a problem going to party where alcohol is involved. I know that alcohol and myself do not go well together. And I'm a much better person when I don't have any substances in my body. And I am living a much better life now than I ever imagined because I no longer do that. And with that, that's enough for me.
Let me ask you this, though.
Yeah.
Okay. If you can think of a time that you, I don't think you've had a, I think you've done an excellent job in your recovery, obviously. But I don't, would it be in a public place like that with a big party and lots of alcohol, or would it be home alone? Which place, which venue would be more tempting, do you think, to have a relapse for you? Because you're a very social guy. You love to party and have fun. You know, that was your reputation, and it's still your personality. But and I know a lot of your problematic drinking happened at home.
And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast, is so everybody knew where I was. You know what I mean? And held me accountable. 18 years ago when I quit smoking, I announced it on TV and they said, hey, if anybody sees me smoking in public, come up and punch me and I'll give you $100. Because
did you really do that?
Yeah. I wanted to be held accountable. Yeah. You know what I mean? I've thought about this. I've thought about if I were to relapse, how would it probably go? Yeah. And I know it wouldn't be in public.
Well, just temptations. Yeah, I have faith you're not going to relapse. But the tempting, like, where would be the setting that would feel like, oh, you know, just that temptation?
A family tragedy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not being able to, I don't know. I can't, I don't want to even think about it. But I think that's where it would be most tempting, where I just want to escape.
That makes sense.
Right now, there's no part of my life that I want to escape from.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I'm living such a fulfilling life right now that I do not want to escape. And I want to be present for everything.
Excellent.
And so if it was something like that, I wouldn't do it at home. And I don't know. I think that's about the only way that I could see something happening. Yeah. And God forbid, I hope it never does.
Yeah, yeah. But that makes sense, and that actually makes a lot of sense for, you know, you're so close with your family, and that means so much to you. I get that.
Yeah. So yeah.
Well, that's a good answer.
So I mean, And I'll go back to this dumb meme. And when we started this podcast 4 years ago, I talked about him a lot. Like my favorite is nothing changes if nothing changes, which is stupid sounding, but so true.
Yeah, yeah.
But the best one I ever described recovery and addiction for me was I gave up everything for one thing. Now I just give up one thing and I get everything.
Yeah, so true.
And to me, that's really what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said at one point, and it's the saddest statement I've ever uttered in my life, is I fought harder to keep alcohol in my life than anything else.
Mm.
And now I fight harder for my sobriety, because with that, I get everything else.
You also don't really like to be told what to do.
Hate it. Hate it.
So have you ever...
Hate it.
Have you ever thought like, well, maybe I can handle...
Nope.
Drinking.
Alcohol
won't tell me what to do. I could handle having some drinks. I'll be fine.
That was my plan for the last 3 years of my addiction.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of people telling me, to sober.
You were finally getting, people were coming out
yeah,
of it.
And yeah, saying, hey, look, this is getting out of control. You've now lost a marriage. You've lost a job. You've lost respect. You've ruined events. But that was my plan. As stupid as it sounds, that was my plan for the last 3 years of my addiction.
I mean, it's stupid in retrospect, but we all do that with something, probably.
I'll just have a couple. I can do this. Look, I've gotten this far. I'm sure I can figure this out. There's just something that I'm missing. I just got to be able to say no. And the reality is once I get one beer in me, I do not have the power to say no. Like, I've had people go, do you think you could have one beer? I go, I don't know. I'm not going to try. Because I have too much
You're a go big, go home kind of guy.
Why would I have one beer? Yeah. That's like having one M&M. Stupid.
I don't think I've ever had one M&M now that you bring it up.
Right? Come on.
Yeah.
I drink beer like Pringles. One is just not enough.
Oh, Pringles. Man, that's another good example.
Right?
Yeah.
Come on. All Before you know it, that whole can's gone.
Yeah.
Hey, we've got a wonderful show for you, and I'm so excited that you're back, Dr. Matt. In case you didn't know, I am $10,000 richer.
Yeah?
We won the show.
That's right.
Survivalist.
Yes.
Yeah.
You did. Yeah. You guys talked about it while I was gone, right?
It was an amazing experience and one that I will remember for the rest of my life. And hopefully my kids will too.
Oh, of course they will. That's an amazing thing.
I said, hey, if they're going to do a winter season, will you go back? And they went,
Once is enough, huh?
Yeah, so we'll see how it goes. Hey, we got an amazing show for you today. We've been trying to get this lovely lady on the show for at least 2 months. Her name is January Riggin. She's the author of Dark Side of the Moon Child, and she's the founder of Soap to Hope, which is a 501c3. Did I say that right?
Yes.
And you go out and do amazing stuff in our community. We're going to find out more about January. You're listening to Project Recovery right here on KSL.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. Our guest today is January Riggin. January, that's a unique name.
It is a unique name. I was born on January 1st.
January
1st. My 30th. Mom was lazy.
She's like, what should we name this kid?
Lazy and mad. Yeah. Being born on the 1st.
I like it.
I love it, too. So tell me where the story of January begins.
Oh, man. Just because I'm on the recovery project, I'll let you guys know that, like, I have 16 years in recovery.
Wow. And, nice.
That's amazing. 16 years is a lot.
It is. Every once in a while, I'm like, I think I want to be the newcomer again. I want all the people to hype up on me.
But you know what? There is something to that. Like, I remember when I saw people getting sober for the first time, and I would say, I'm kind of envious. And they go, why are you envious of me? Because I go, because the road you're about to go down is so wonderful if you let it be.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like watching a baby deer walk for the first time or a newborn figure out something. You're like, oh, you see that light in their eyes and you go, oh, wow, everything is so magical.
You know, recovery is magical, but when I was new, I struggled. I had so much trauma and anger, and my narrative that I told myself for so long is that I didn't belong here, that I wasn't worth this. I couldn't have a life that was worth living. Like, the circumstances that were built against me my entire life have just proven that. So I didn't think recovery would work for me. And so I never had any relapses, right? Like, I never had any relapses because I never wanted to get clean. And so when recovery actually happened, because I got into treatment and I had to start facing myself and see those, like, steps, I struggled. I was upset that, like, that I didn't know how to manage this, I didn't know how to control this, that I needed something to numb who I was, I didn't like who I saw in the mirror, And all of those things came back that have happened to me, but now I didn't get to have a coping skill. And so I struggled probably my first couple of years, and I had to fight for every day. Like, it wasn't like I had a whole family support. I had money. I had, I literally had to catch a bus to get on another bus to get to another bus to even make it to a meeting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it wasn't, or to treatment, or I had to get on assistance to even survive to get food that month, because I still had such a poverty mentality and such an criminal mentality, but an addiction mentality that, like, I don't like what I have and I don't like who I am, so I want to take what's yours.
Yeah.
And so, like, nothing was never enough, right? Like, if people were eating at McDonald's or whatever it was, or if I walked by a restaurant, like, I knew I couldn't afford that. And so, like, I struggled. I think my first year, like, now that I think about it, it was probably the best, right? Like, I had to fight for all those days, and they had to matter for me. Because I would have probably tried to manipulate someone.
Okay, before we get to that, because I love where you're going down this, but I think a lot of people would be interested to what got you to that point. So do you remember the first time you tried a substance, or the first time you're introduced to alcohol?
Well, you mentioned off air that your growing up situation was kind of unique in that you grew up on a Native American reservation, but you were a minority, not
right.
a Native American.
No, I wasn't.
Tell us a little bit about your family and where you grew up.
So I come from a broken home. My dad's a Vietnam vet, because when you said that, I did, like, it triggers. Mm. And he passed away when he was 54. Poverty. Lived in a trailer park my entire life. Moved to Indian reservation when my parents divorced because my grandma had land on there. And my dad stayed on a trailer there. This divorce, I only have one sibling, and he's older, and he's a severe alcoholic, and I'm a severe drug addict. And he went into the military too. So alcoholism, I have a lot of people in my family that struggle from alcoholism that went to the war in the military and came back with addiction too. Like, started mm-hmm. coping with heroin, started coping with methamphetamine, crack cocaine. And so that piece was normalized. And being raised on an Indian reservation, alcoholism is prominent.
It's a rampant problem.
Yeah, it's rampant. Yeah. And, but my mom took me and my dad took my brother. So they split the siblings. And there was a lot of trauma there. There was a lot of, my mom was a partier. My dad had a lot of health problems from the war and working, heart conditions. So he basically lived off disability. My mom tried to do everything she could, working 4 or 5 jobs. But in that midst of a child being left alone, there was a lot of trauma that happened in there. In those
what
houses.
Was that like being separated from your brother?
That was probably the hardest. And what's crazy is, even though Todd is like 4 years older than me, like he was protective over me, because we lived in areas that were pretty, like the trailer park was crazy. That, you know, having a little sister, like
unsafe.
A brother over a little sister, like, it's a different bond. Uh-huh. Where, like, so when we split, like, it was, like, almost like losing a limb there. And he's the one that went to the reservation first. And then when my dad got me back from my mom literally dropped me off at McDonald's and just said, hey, your dad's coming to get you, and just left me there. And so then
wow.
I went and lived with my dad. And he tried his hardest. Like, he tried to raise 2 kids on his own with the best he could. Up on this property, he tried to, like, give us, you know, camping or hunting or a 4-wheeler or a 3-wheeler. But even in that mentality, with the stuff that was being built up as a secret, like, I have sexual assault as a child, and I wanted to protect my dad because he is military, right? Like, my dad's very disciplined. You don't show emotion. You don't show that those things affect you. You don't show weakness. You don't show pain. I'll backhand you. You will not, you know, it's not is or was, it is now, right? Like, and he was really hard on my brother that way too. Like, and so, you know, as like even a 7-year-old, we were out there like, chopping wood, we were picking, like, we were tough. Like, you just couldn't have a weak mind. So any of that trauma that was already building, I couldn't express it anyways.
So you just put it in a dark place?
Yeah, you just put it in a dark
place. Did you ever feel like you got any help or support for that?
No, not for a long, not for, till I got into
recovery.
Yeah, till I was 30.
And, you know, I think it's interesting, and I don't, you know, it's a different mindset. You've used that term. It's a different generation. Like, you know, bad things happen to everybody, so just be tough. And I understand that. I think parents probably tried their best.
Oh, my, you know? both my, and now that
but
I look at it.
Now that we know what trauma does and how it influences a person's growth, you know, I hope we're changing and accepting that, you know, understanding how to get help for people who've been assaulted or traumatized, especially as children, is important.
But you got to look back. You know, it was a different time and it was a different era. And we say this in recovery all the time. We only know what we know. And you know what I mean? And that's all that, you know, those generations knew.
And that's what I mean. I think a lot of parents, you know, we can't judge past generations by current mindsets. I don't think that's fair.
Oh, no.
But, you know, I'm getting this picture of here's a dad. He obviously wanted to provide experiences for you guys. But he was, you know, dealing with his own trauma, PTSD, I'm sure. And, and then his own alcoholism and those kinds of things. So, and he's on his own raising
kids.
Yeah, it's
interesting.
You know,
my dad was a severe alcoholic until I turned one. Oh, and when I turned one, he cold turkey.
Oh, did he?
My dad. Now, my other side of the family, their addiction ran. I mean, I just buried an uncle that was a Purple Heart hero 3 times that from alcoholism last year. So, there's certain sides, but he quit when I turned one, and I don't know what that trigger was. I don't know what stopped him. I don't know if it was having a little girl. I don't know if something traumatic happened in his life. I have no idea. I was one, right? But I was never. My dad was my. I have a tattoo on me that's a tree. And it's my dad, right? Like his property, his house, like it never changed. My mom moved around, different men, different places. Like for him though, like I always knew even at my darkest times, I could go up that mountain and my dad would be home.
He was planted
like
there.
He was sitting on his chair reading the Bible. Right. Like I always knew that my dad was there until obviously I lost my dad when I was like 20. And because he was stubborn. I think military men are pretty stubborn.
They
don't want to go to the doctor. They don't want to do anything. And by the time I lost him, I was already a full blown like meth addict at that time. But they separated us. But the time when I went back there, I tried like he tried. Like, he tried the best he could with what he had, and I tried to hold the secrets as best as I could with what I had.
Did you ever tell your dad about
it? No. I tried to tell him without voicing it. Like, I had a severe suicide attempt where I took all of my dad's pills, because my dad had to take severe pills every day. Like, he had 5 heart attacks before I was 18. They had to do. So I ended up taking all of his pills, and he walked in the room and he rushed me in Child Protective Service and tried to pump my stomach and I would go back and forth. My dad disliked my mom, pretty much hated her. And when they divorced, you know, that type of divorce where it's like awful, arrogant, rude. When I would go back and forth, but my brother would never go see my mom. I would go back and forth to my mom's, and I had Stockholm, I would say, with my mom. Mm-hmm. Even though horrific things happened to me while she was partying or while she was gone or whoever was in her house, or I got to have those little moments of, oh, maybe I'll get a beer. Oh, maybe they'll offer me a joint. Oh, maybe I'll sneak a line when they're all not looking. Right?
As a child, you were thinking that as a child.
So I wanted to be there to numb and build, like, and I mean, and I live such a double life, right? Neither one of my parents. My mom, I was angry. I would get angry. I mean, my mom's my abuser. Like, my mom was in some horrific relationships that, for her to gain any kind of sense of control, she had to control something else, right?
And you were the...
Yeah, and I was, you know, I remember clearly, like, one time holding my mom down so bad for her to stop that, like, I left marks on her, and then they took me in. Right. Like, when the therapist finally met with me and I shared what happened, right? Because nobody asks you what happens to you, right? They think something's wrong with you. They think you're a delinquent. You think you're defiant. You think you're wild. And when I finally was like, what else am I supposed to do to get her to stop hitting me? Right. And the therapist actually finally, right then and there, called my mom in and was like, this is done. She's going to her dad's now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that little spitfire of anger got me to tell the truth one time.
Mm.
But then that's a mistake sometimes, right? Like, then all of a sudden.
How did that make you feel that you got taken from your mom then at that point?
Because that was where I got to be wild and angry. It was a lot of fear for me. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think I do have Stockholm syndrome with my mom at the time. Like, right now, though, my mom, you couldn't tell me anything about my mom. My mom is my favorite human in the world. Like, she's a riot. She's fun. I spend as much time. She lives in O-Town.
Oh, BDBDO.
she lives, you know.
Can I ask, is she sober?
Yeah, my mom, yeah. She would use, but she could go to work. Like, she worked my entire life for 3 or 4 jobs. Okay. She could, yeah. She didn't have the, like, where addiction destroyed her and turned her into
So she
this.
Was functional, but yeah. Partied a lot. Yeah.
And she liked to have fun.
And it sounds like you've had a lot of therapy with her, but back to being a kid, I'm curious about this. So here you have this trauma in your life, Stockholm syndrome, meaning that you're identifying with your captors or your abusers, right? And so you don't want to give up, you know, get them in trouble. So you never kind of rat out to your dad what's going on over at your mom's. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or even about my dad, because my dad was, military. I mean, believe it or not, us kids raised by military, I mean, I'm 45, that like, we got our ass beat.
Yes.
Like, nowadays, people go to
corporal punishment. Yeah.
Yeah. Or less. I mean, but like, I was a kid that went to school all the time with bruises or malnutrition. Like, we were poor too. Like, yeah. I started stealing at a really young age. And nowadays, people are like, why? Like, nobody missed the signs. Why would a 8-year-old be going into a grocery store trying to steal food? It's right. Not because they're delinquent, right. Because they're hungry.
They're hungry, yeah.
They're hungry.
It's very, very sad, isn't it?
You know what I mean? It's not.
Well, and I hope that people like myself, psychologists, social workers, healthcare professionals, that we've also changed. Like, parenting has improved, I think, over the decades and generations. But hopefully we see those signs now and we don't assume delinquency. In fact, I don't even really care for that term. It's more of a description of a behavior, but it's not an understanding of the person, right?
Right.
And so you're absolutely right. When we have an 8-year-old coming in to steal at a grocery store, we need to find out what the bigger problem is. But for you as a young child, do you remember how young you were the first time you used anything, drank?
I probably tried. My brother was drink. I probably ten. My brother tried to get me to take a swig of Everclear.
And you probably
Everclear at 10. Wow.
Yeah.
And I puked all over my grandma's. Like,
but I wonder, was it curiosity? Or was it numbing?
Numbing, yeah. It was, I mean, there is some little bit of me trying to, I'm the little sister of a brother, and I have a brother that was actually kind of the cool kid. Like, he was really good in sports, and I was really good. Like, or my
you
dad
wanted to
was,
be like your brother.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and I don't really know if it what it was, but.
How about identifying with your mom? Like, were you trying to make connection
none of
with
that.
Her?
No? I mean, really, in reality, like that, like, it feels like that time was kind of minute compared to what was brewing, right? Like, I at that point, I became the perfect ingredient for a predator, right? Like, I mean, I started using methamphetamine, weed, drinking, probably full-blown, like 11, 12, right? So like me having trauma, being raised,
so
being able
to like barely into sixth grade.
Yeah, like I ended up being a perfect ingredient for predators where like I ended up being attracted to older men, probably from my sexual abuse, right? Like, and normalizing that. I ended up getting trafficked on a big biker gang property for like 6 years in my entire life. And that was normalized. Like, I needed that property to go pick up that substance where I learned how to make methamphetamine. I knew how to use methamphetamine. I knew how to mule those drugs for that biker gang. I knew how to sell very well at a really young age. I knew where I was a full-blown adult at like 12. Like, I knew what I was doing.
But so, you were trafficked.
Yeah, sex trafficked, yeah.
And so that was.
But that
started,
wasn't a word they used back then either. No, that had barely hit mainstream maybe over the past 10 years. But right. Back then, that was not. That was an exchange because they were giving me drugs. I needed that drug. I needed safety.
So as young as 12, 13 years old, you were in that biker gang life.
Yeah, I was already in that scene of, and actually, I write about it in here, but one of the hugest thing is the property gave me power, right? It let us teens go on there and have bonfires, have cakes, have booze, have lines, have sex, be angry. We could fight. We could yell. Like, at some point, it was home.
So
nobody held us hostage. I wasn't
private property.
Yeah, I wasn't held hostage, but it was home because I needed what they had and they needed me. Mm-hmm. So at some point, you normalize that too.
Did it feel, and I, because I say this because I think a lot of teenagers, it felt like you had something important going on, like you were an important part of the group.
Gave you
purpose? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And plus, too. I think kids that come from that background were looking for maternal, right? Mm-hmm. And so if there's, I had a female trafficker. She always looked for me. She would brush my hair. She would feed me. She would bathe me. She would make sure I was okay. She made sure I had enough drugs. She would tell me that I was the most important. That, like, she never left that property unless she was coming to find me and make sure I was okay, right? And so at some point, there is a maternal toxic blonde going that there's no one could tell me different about her, and I was already sexually distorted that, like, giving up sex was just part of the normalization, right? I had no idea that this was like trafficking or exploitation or being someone like that wasn't the word.
Did you feel like sex was your currency or it was your worth? I mean,
no, yeah. Well, and I had a lot, like, I was a kid that could mule drugs for them too, right? Like, I was their currency all the way around, right? I went and sold into these small rural towns. I mean, obviously that area, Durango, Ignacio, like all those little areas, like, what else is there to do in small towns, right? And so I became currency. I became a valuable to them and they became value to me. So I really thought of it like they were my street mom. I thought it was my street mom and I thought I was a street kid. And what happened is the system failed me, right? Like this, I went in twice before I was 16 to an abortion clinic, didn't have to have a parent sign. I could walk in there with cash. Nobody asked me what happened to
really?
Me.
Really? Wow. Okay.
And nobody asked me anything, right?
No, nobody.
I could go. I walked in there. I walked in there
therapy.
A teenager with money and I literally walked out of there different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do
you think at that age you would have accepted help though? Because you're kind of painting, I mean, it's that you've used the term Stockholm syndrome, normalization. Like as a child and a young person, we start to, our experiences create what seems normal and typical to us.
Oh yeah. That,
right?
I don't
and
know
so
if I would have.
I think that,
I mean, I
at
mean,
that age you probably felt like, why, you know, I don't want, I, where would I go? What would I do? Like these are the only people I know. Like you said, a street mom.
Right.
There was this twisted and unhealthy connection, but it was a connection.
And I needed that connection.
Can I ask you a weird question? Like the 6 years you spent trafficking
off and on. Yeah,
off and on. Like, and I don't know if you can even answer this. Do you feel like you were winning life or do you feel like you were just surviving life? Does that make sense?
Well, no sense in a way winning. I mean, but I get what you're saying because there's some power that comes along with that, right? Like I actually ended up being a kid that groomed and targeted and brought other kids because there was, you got to be wild there. You got drugs, you got freedom, you got this, you got to, older people were accepting you. And so there is some winning there, right? Where like, and like I said, none of that targeting, grooming, recruiting were none of those words back then. We were all just kids just needing a place to go, right? And so owning that story and it coming out not about 6 years ago, right? Like that's a story that you block pretty hard, right? That you, there, you look back now, there was actually more survival, right? But there is when, as a teen, why not? Why would you not be like, dude, I got a pocket full of dope and you need what I want and people are buying it from me, yeah, there's some winning, right? There's there's some power, there's some control. And so, but that power and control, I mean, landed me, I was one of the first few kids that ever, I went to prison at 16, right? I was one of the first kids to ever do this Scared Straight program. Oh. And I'm in Colorado. And, but what's crazy is they were so unmanaged at that time. They had no idea about Scared Straight. Like, they just threw you in there. They thought you were going to be punked by some inmates and you're never going to go back, yeah, right? There was no trauma therapy going on. Yeah. Like, if you're taking a 16-year-old to prison, like, there's a problem going on.
So do you know the research on that program?
I know a little bit. I know it didn't work for me.
it didn't work for anybody. So what they found was, is that the kids that went there tended to identify with the inmates.
That's me.
And they were like, oh, these guys are cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are my people.
Yeah. And so if you were bad enough to get into the Scared Straight program, then your heroes weren't school teachers. Your heroes were drug dealers.
That's exactly
and
what happened.
And so when you went to prison, they identified with those folks. And actually were more likely to choose a life of crime.
So that was me. So right after.
Yeah. At 16, how much time did you do in prison?
So I started, that's where the start of the in and out. And I went back in. They tried me. I got tried as an adult.
Did you get busted for muling or drug
there
sales?
Was a lot. I robbed a house, thought the lady was gone. She wasn't. She ended up having a heart attack. And they tried to say it was if she would have died, they probably would have got me for attempted murder. But she was scared, right? And she had no idea that it was like a 14-year-old, like a young kid. She thought it was a grown ass man trying to break in her house and maybe even sexually assault her or hurt her.
Right.
So her panic, she was terrified. But that just started the ripple effect of just criminal behavior for me and being in the system. So any charges after that just automatically were all, you're bad. You're going to, one person thought I needed help.
Yeah, nobody was like, why is this kid breaking into this house?
Obviously, I got a felony. I started, burglary, then manufacturing methamphetamine, having possession, fraud, counterfeit. Checks, like everything that I could get my hands on to not be myself and belong somewhere else, I did.
Tell me about that, to not be myself. What do you mean by that?
Well, obviously, I didn't want to be the weak, wounded little girl that was molested as a kid, right? Or constantly, consensually raped, right? I didn't want to associate with that at all. So if the criminal behavior, the power would help me disassociate from that one, I ran with that criminal mentality too far. Too far.
but I mean, that's so important. The truth is. That is what, at that age, our adolescence, we're looking for our identity, for our power. Where do I fit in? Who am I? How can I set myself apart? I've got to feel important. I've got to be important. That's really the drive of our personality development when we're adolescents. And the reality is, if you can't find it, in a socially acceptable way, sometimes you'll find it in criminal ways, right?
Oh, yeah. You want to know, what's crazy about my story is that I lived
I'm going to stop you there because there's a lot that's crazy about your story. You know what's crazy? You just talked about, horrific stuff going on.
Well, I think this one is probably the most craziest because is the double life. Like, that was all, nightlife. There was a time that I shifted and went into that, right? But during the day, I loved my dad. So during the day, I couldn't let anybody see that girl. Because if someone told
you didn't want your dad to find out.
No, or shame, right?
Right.
You
didn't want to disappoint him.
But so I went to school.
Oh, okay.
I made every sport. I made varsity.
So you were excelling on both sides of the page.
I probably not. I mean, I probably made D's and C's, but I went to these areas to protect my dad. Probably at the end of the day was it. And not to protect myself, but to protect my
heartbreak.
To protect your dad and probably to protect your story a little bit.
Because
if something comes out and your dad's like, well, she's going to school, she's on all the teams, this can't be true.
Right. And I I needed that double life. I needed this over here, and I couldn't, I wasn't a voice. I tell people, and it's in this book, and it says it in the back. I will tell you right now, my first trafficker is not a human. It is silence. Globally, silence is the number one trafficker.
Interesting.
But I learned how to be silent at six. So everything else after that, all was a secret.
Yeah.
And so I never was a voice, but I knew action. I knew certain things that would protect this side of the story. Yeah. So, or like I weighed like this much, or I had bruises, or I was wearing long sleeves because I was already shooting up dope. I played that role so well.
Yeah.
That I don't even know what narrative was true anymore, right? Like, yeah, I didn't even know who, I had no clue where.
Yeah, that identity wasn't solidly
based.
But
all I knew is that my dad depended on, in this small town, he would show up for every practice and every game. That was my connection to him.
Yeah, wow.
And so I knew that if I seen him, that maybe there was some real to my life. Right. There was some.
He's your tree.
There was a different reality.
He's your tree.
Going. Yeah. He was my tree. He was the only reality I had.
Yeah.
It's weird to say. But like, I knew that no matter what was going on, regardless if that night I was going to get raped, or if that night was me sleeping with six or seven men, or if that night I'm going to use too much dope. Right. Like, whatever that is, that like, I got to see him.
Yeah.
I got to see him. Sooner or later, that addiction got so powerful, right? Like, I stopped seeing him all the time, right? But, like, I knew, and obviously high school runs out, right? And I didn't make the cut for being scouted by the end of my high school years. But not only going into those abortion clinics, I became a teen mom to an older man because I normalized being with these people. And I buried her.
You buried your daughter?
My first daughter, yeah. Yeah, I buried her by the time she would have almost been three. Oh. So I was a teen mom full of trauma, addiction,
what
abusive boy, abusive relationship beyond abuse, right? Like beyond that. And the only thing that probably saved me from that relationship is that my drug was more powerful. I decided that I needed to go chase my drug than stay at home and be abused.
Mm.
And so I have a lot of respect for addiction sometimes for those types of things, right? Mm. I ran with her. I tried to run from him. And during my addiction, my dad had to come. I was running down the road. Someone picked me up. I was barefoot, naked, with her in my hands, running from another predator. And I finally called my dad, and I haven't seen him for like a year. And he drove like 8 hours to come pick me up and was so disappointed, right? That finally, that story came out. And they tried to get me better. I tried to come off all those substances that I was being fed by this predator for probably about 6 month period. And by that time, someone let her go to his hands. And the truth is I got a flight for life call that she didn't make it. 30 days later. I don't know what happened in that home.
You don't know what happened.
I mean, there's a lot of speculation.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to blame me and say that I was an addict mom that couldn't take the negligence and put her in an unsafe home, which it's her father's, right? But at this point, there was so many abuse charges from domestic violence from me and him that it was considered an unsafe home. But I don't know if we'll ever know the truth.
No.
Wow.
But burying your first child as a teen. Again. But well, because I'm on the run, I already have criminal charges. I'm not supposed to be using. They found out I'm using, right? So I'm in prison again.
So they think that's the safest place for you.
I don't know. It became my only father figure.
Well, it's a punishment mentality, and that's what we've talked about a lot on this show. Is that, you know, punishment doesn't create positive change.
No. So you were telling me off air at some point you did 10 years in prison,
off and on. Yeah. Maybe a couple times here and there. That was it.
And this was all in Colorado?
All in Colorado.
What brought you to Utah?
My brother. My brother was in the military. He did, I think, he actually graduated high school a year early to go into military. He wanted out of this small little town.
Yeah. Right?
And one of the ways out is Job Corps or the military. Or the military, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, believe it or not, back then, right? And so I think he did about 8-9 years in the military before he got out and lived in – he came to Salt Lake City with his wife at the time. And I think he was trying to start a family.
Mm-hmm.
And I got – I actually expired my number. And I remember clearly one of the conversations – they can't hold you past midnight when you expire your number. So that means that you've done your time and your parole.
Okay.
Right?
I didn't know what that meant.
I expired my number, and they can't hold you past midnight, right? Like 12:01, like you have to be released. Yeah. Okay. Like you're no longer warded to the state, mm-hmm. right, as an inmate or as whatever it is. And my mom picked me up, which is interesting that, like, I ended up at a bar. At 12:05, I never was a drinker, which is so weird. Like I've maybe have been fully blown out drunk 5 times in my entire life. Ever
that never ever. Was a big
nope,
thing for you.
I was a full blown street addict, full blown heroin, meth, crack cocaine. No, I've never taken a synthetic drug. I've never done like oxys and none of that. Never ever.
Okay.
Not even in recovery. I've never even gotten a prescription for it.
Huh.
So I know I still kind of hold on to that junkie pride. I don't know if that came out kind of junkie pride-ish.
No, it's okay.
That's okay.
Here's the honesty. Like all that you've been through, you're still upbeat. You move out to Utah. And what was your thought process coming to Utah?
Well, wherever you run, there you are. That's the truth. What's weird is I drove back and forth home because I'm like what you said at the very beginning of this. I'm okay using alone. I'm really good at using alone, actually, right? Uh-huh. And I would drive back forth home to people I knew and bring me back my own little methamphetamine or my own little supply. Well, and or at this time because I turned into a full blown heroin addict in prison. Never touched it before ever in my life until I got to prison.
Oh.
Why is and that? Because I went, that was the most accessible?
Yes.
Or and was it the most that, bang for your buck?
Well, that and who wants to be up, spracked out in prison?
Oh, yeah.
Right. I'd rather be down. And going in at a really young age, like I tell it in my story or my book, is that, you know, I got raped by the first guard and you become trafficked by a badge in there too, right? Mm. Like if you go in there so young, you're definitely going to be targeted by guards. Like, you have a lot to prove.
Isn't that so sad?
Oh, like, it happens so
much. There's
no
safety.
It's heartbreaking. And there's no safety. And they have so much power because if you report them, they can pull your parole date.
They can do all
They can
sorts
get
of
you
things.
Charged in there. They can set you up. Who's going to believe an inmate that has a rap record, right? Like, so... So I would come back and forth with my... And use... I didn't know a lot of users here, but as soon as that opens... Like, once you start looking for it, like, right, I found out there was a strip club here, and I was like, oh, I'll find a predator there. I'll go sit by the old dude on the, you know, ICU unit right there. I'll go talk
to
him.
So you were searching for predators.
Oh, yeah. And I was searching for people that I know that use, that I can be normalized around, especially in Utah, because I didn't know anybody. And so my life got pretty destructive in the city. I started, you know, selling myself. Curbside selling, prostitution, whatever that is, to survive that. And then I get arrested one more time.
Now,
probably about a year and a half.
Were your intentions different when you came to Utah?
Like, oh, yeah. My brother, I was offered everything. My brother owned his own business. I had my own house. I could rent the whole basement to myself. My brother loved me, right? I had,
Your intention was, hey, I'm going to do this clean. I'm going to work. I'm going to have a
different life.
I thought
I was, but I still haven't had any treatment
or resources.
Our trauma informed care.
No, I don't think you're set up for
in your addiction. Nobody's ever stopped you and said, "Hey, would you like some help?"
Yeah, or what happened to you? Nobody asked me. Not one person. Everybody thought something was wrong with me. That's the truth. And I looked crazy. I acted crazy, but who doesn't in those situations? Like you don't But that was the first time ever being arrested, and I told you guys this earlier, going in front of a judge, and he said, I'm sentencing you to treatment. And I said, no, you're not. Send me to prison. And he goes, no, I'm sending you to treatment.
Why did you want to go to prison?
Because I know how to be in prison. I know how to be an inmate. I know how to get my supply. I know how to have sex. I know how to link up with my people. I know how to survive in that environment. I've been doing it my entire life. So
recovery was unknown.
No, unknown. So he won.
Well, he's a judge. Yeah. That's how that works.
He won the battle. He won the sentencing, if you want to know. Yeah. And
you mean you weren't able to talk a judge out of it, huh?
Nope. And I'm going to tell you, there's a couple of things that happened before that actual recovery hit. He tried to send me to drug court. They let me out because it's outpatient, basically. Right, I went on the run, right? And I ended up back in the cycle and then went back to jail. And then he said, well, now we need to up your level of care, right? And he's like, I'm going to put you... I think at the time in Davis County it was RSAT. There's an RSAT program in the jail where there was treatment in the jail. So he said, I'm going to put you in there. As soon as they release me, I relapse and do what I don't call it a relapse because I don't really think I was ready for recovery at the time.
Well, I was
going
to say, did you want treatment?
Right.
I mean,
right. And so probably a few months later, the last time I used. Was that I'll never forget the last time I used. I will never forget. I was like 80 pounds. I was malnutritioned. My skin tone was like greenish because I was so malnutritioned, so gone, really couldn't even remember my name. And withdrawing in a jail, like I literally like bowel movements on myself, scratching, the pain, the aches. Like I think a couple of the Weber County guards were like, I think we should release her. She's like a liability right at this point, right? Like I
looked like you were gonna
die. Like screaming, restless. Like I'll never forget that. Because I'm gonna tell you that right there will probably keep me in recovery. Because it's easier to stay here than to get here.
And we've had so many people who have come on this podcast and who said they'd welcome death because they feared detox.
Oh.
They're like bring on the death. Because death, we know there's going to be an end point. But withdrawals and detox, no.
And it's weird because I do outreach now and we'll get there. But like... It's so I have that conversation now with people, right? Where I'm like, you're not going to die from withdrawing. You're going to die from using.
Yeah.
But out there in the middle of that, it doesn't feel like that. Yeah. Like people will choose. I'd rather die than to stop using. And people do. There's a lot of people that die that shouldn't die. Like, right? Like they're just trying to get high. They're trying to cope. And we have, our overdose rate and people dying from all sides of addiction, right? Drunk drivers, overdoses, under the influence of doing something stupid if you're a gang member or you're trying to prove yourself. Like all those things, like the death that comes from having something in your body is awful.
So you find yourself sitting in a court-ordered rehab.
Yeah, all-female one. Which is for like nowadays they're co-ed and I don't agree with it, but that's just my opinion. But I'm grateful I went to an all-female treatment center.
And how does that go? Because everything else you had wanted, but now you're here forced and...
I'm here. I met probably the most incredible PhD therapist in my life. He didn't consider me an experiment. I will not do therapy because of that. I can still be an experiment because people, like, they'll hear your story and they think, oh, my God, right? And then they want to start to fix you.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to fix me. He just wanted to listen to me.
And nobody had listened to you because you had never said anything because you said silence was your first trafficker.
Yeah, and that man, I will forever be indebted. Like, he is, like, even till this day, I will show up somewhere, even on his lunch break where he works, somewhere, and say, I love you and thank you. Because he was the first. And the first one that started to let me make choices. Like, they would tell me, hey, if you don't want to be here, this isn't locked. You can go anywhere you want. You can leave. Like, my counselor she was pretty ruthless. She was like, yo, check it out. I don't get paid to babysit you. I get paid to help you.
Addiction counselors are
Hey, you're not.
My guy said the same thing to me.
Yeah, he's like, you're not. I'm not going to sit here and worry all the time. You know, you're being rude or you're trying to look for a way out. You want to get kicked out. You don't have to get kicked out. I needed that. I needed tough love at the time.
My therapist told me in our first meeting, he goes, if you're going to lie to me for an hour and a half, don't.
Yeah.
I got other things to do. And two, I don't want your sobriety worse than you do. So
well, that's it right there. I mean, you have to. It is such a huge challenge to turn your life around and not just get sober, but change all those mentalities. You know, the criminal mentality, the addict mentality. You have to want it more than anybody else. And so, I think that it makes sense that the therapists and the counselors are like, "Listen, we're here for you, and we'll do everything we can for you. But if you don't want to be here, you don't have to be here."
Yeah.
And that forces you into that forced choice. Like, well, what am I going to do? Stay or go?
Oh, yeah. I was beat down by that time. Right. I'm 29. My whole life has been, I don't think I've had one day without a substance or something traumatic happening in my life since I was like 10 or 11. Right. And even earlier than that. Right. Like, and so I think I was just beat.
Sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yeah, I think I was beat. I was beat. And so when they gave me consent and choice and listen to me, I was like, maybe I should stay for like a couple more days, you know? And then maybe I should stay for a couple more days. And like, and that's how I looked at it. And that's why I was telling you guys, like, my first year in recovery was not like the unicorns. Like, it was literally like every day I told myself, hey, guess what? Are you going to stay here? Are you going to go put a needle in your arm? Are you going to stay here? And I would, every day I'd be like, hey, stay. I would look at myself in the mirror and ask myself that every day. What are you going to do? And I'm grateful for the treatment center I went to because they did offer peers coming in, regardless if that was a 12-step program or different peers coming in to share their story, share what they went through, got to hear what they've been, and that they're here and that their life looks way better. Or I got to go to meetings. They took us to listen, you know, and I got to see people actually doing this, even though I was kind of, I'm like, I don't know if they're really telling the truth, right? Or like, are they really 9 years clean in sobriety? I don't believe it. But like, it started to like see them every week too. Well, consistently, they were showing up.
It sounds like, and we've talked about this before, you saw a little hope. And I mean, I'm going to hazard a guess here, but I don't think you saw a lot of hope in the early years of your life.
Oh, no. So, yeah, something, there was a spark, right? And I kept on going. Like, and some of the peers that I met that did have some sobriety, like, they loved me until I couldn't love myself. I had nobody else out here. I didn't know anybody. I mean, my brother was here, and by that time, he's building his family, and he's, you know, he's like, my sister's is a dope fiend addict, right? Like, who knows if she's going to stay this time, right? And so I started to build a community around me, people, and that was incredible. Like, I haven't had that. And I started my job, like, the person I worked for, like, started to love me as a person. And, like, yeah, I would show up every day, never missed a day. Like, whatever that trigger was to, like, this might be worth exploring because I don't know if I'm going to make it again. I might just end my life at this point.
Do you think that was the first time that you found real value in the person that you were instead of what you could do for someone?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, and like I said, I just haven't, I mean, I've looked, I've been looking, but I haven't found reason to pick up. And that, I'm going over 16 years. So it's not like I haven't looked. There's some things in my life where I'm like,
well,
tragic.
Yeah.
Family tragic. I've had that.
You talked about 10 years being sober and had a suicide attempt.
Yeah, I will. This will be a good segue because that's how Sober to Hope started, is this mental breakdown. Is obviously I'm sharing that shared this piece of the story because now it's told, but at 10 years it was not told. I never shared any of the sexual violence towards me.
So you'd been sober 10 years before you shared that?
Any of it, right? I did a lot of grief counseling. Like, so when I was in treatment, I did a lot of grief counseling, losing my kid, losing my dad, losing countless friends, losing myself, losing my identity. But I never talked about that stuff, right?
I was still locked up.
Never talked about the trafficking, the sexual
never.
Assault, the rapes.
And I wouldn't. I took so much pride in addiction. I was like, I was just an addict. And I still held on to, was that really it? Like, I really still thought for a long time it was just my addiction. This is an exchange. I actually was a drug dealer. I wasn't a victim. Like, actually, that's what. And so I really didn't own that. And really, I think pieces of your story need to come out when they need to.
Well, we've said that before, and where I go, I'm being as honest as I can be right now.
Right.
Right now, because whether it's you or me or whatever, this is as honest as I can be right now.
And I needed to work on my daughter's death more than anything else because I was tired of honoring her with a needle in my arm. Like, I had the perfect excuse to use every day. Mm. Like, every day. You couldn't tell me different. I mean, I could convince therapists to say, yeah, I understand why you used every day, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, literally, I had, and I was so shameful for that, that, like, I am grateful at the time of my early recovery. That's what I chose to work on, was her death, well, and to honor her differently.
That makes sense that that so, would
but there was a lot
first,
of stuff
yeah.
that didn't get worked on.
Sure.
10 years clean, kind of going through a situation. I've been in a relationship for 10 years, kind of really not wanting to be there, not understanding what's going on sexually. Like, I'm acting out sexually. I'm kind of like, honestly, I'm cheating. I'm like, weird stuff's going on. And I have a great life. And my relationship, like, he's a good man, right? I didn't know what was going on where I was kind of spiraling out. And I remember clearly, I walked into a gas station and there's this old biker white dude walks in there smelling like diesel mechanic, BO, and cocaine. Like, literally. Mm. And I call it the smell of trauma, and I wrote it. It's the first story in there, the smell of trauma.
That was your trigger, huh?
And I couldn't walk. I got to my car and I couldn't even start my damn car. It was the smell of that smell triggered all of that. Like, I barely made it home, and I stayed in a fetal position for like 4 days, like flashback after flashback, being on this property and what was really going, seeing your trauma as a third person from that trigger trauma response.
I didn't
think I was gonna make it. I was like, what else, God? Are you kidding me? Like, this is the more to my story that you're going to tell me now. Like, I've done everything you've asked to stay here. I've given up time, energy, steps. I've been to every meeting, doing every service project. I've sponsored women. I've let people sponsor me. I've done all, like, I was angry.
And, well, you wanted to keep that stuff locked away because that's what you'd always done with
it. Yeah, and I called my ex at the time because I obviously ruined that relationship, and I handed him over $10,000 and asked him. I did have another daughter. At the time that she came back into my life in recovery, she was 7, and she's never left. So I've raised her now for 16 years. I got her my first year back in recovery. Her dad somehow or another asked me to come pick her up. Went and picked her up, and he's never wanted her back. And I'm like, dope. I get to raise this little thing, hopefully better than I got raised, right? But I asked him, I said, hey, here's $10,000. I've been saving it. Will you take care of him? I'll sign over her to you because that's the only person she knew for 10 years. And I'm done. I'm done doing this recovery thing. I'm done doing the hope thing. I'm done doing faith thing. I'm done looking at myself. I'm done finding out new things about myself that I just don't know if I can swallow anymore, really. And yeah, I had it all set up. I was like, that's it. I think I'm going to go hurt the guy that hurt me, right? Like, I had this like whole revenge mentality going on, and then I'm going to blow my brains out and I'm going to be done. Mm. And thank God I did it.
What stopped you?
My best friend. I was driving down the road. He drove all the way from Logan. He was my best friend in recovery. I was on the road back home because, you know, all the people I had on my hit list for Colorado.
Everybody I had
on my step eight.
You had a hit list. Yeah.
Lipstick list.
Yeah, lipstick list. And he drove all the way there and found me on I-15, pulled me over and took me to the monastery for like 5 hours in Ogden.
Oh, wow.
And I sat up there.
What a good friend.
Yeah, and I was like, And I moved to Salt Lake on my own. And obviously at this time, my kid's older, right? She's 17 by the time this is happening. When it happened, she chose to move out, do her own thing, and move in with her boyfriend. And she needed a family, and I wasn't providing any of it because I was losing my mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what was happening with this mental breakdown, with this trauma response. I couldn't even put sentences together. Mm-hmm. I was mumbling all over again.
Well, that's how powerful trauma can be, yeah.
Yeah, I was mumbling all over again. That was the thing my dad tried to put me in speech therapy because I mumbled when he got me back, and he was like, something's wrong
with
her.
You're regressing.
Yeah, and I did not know what was happening.
Yeah.
And I got to finally put a word to it. I started to research what this really was, and there's this word that came up, that exploitation, trafficking,
mm-hmm.
Sexual assault, molestation, right? What all these words, right? There was something to this that happened to other people, and I thought it was only me, so this was my own little dirty secret, right? And I just started actually listening to Survivor podcasts and listening to other people's story and trying to identify and trying to put a new narrative to it as a survivor instead of a victim, obviously. And went to Thailand to do a lot of energy healing work, mm-hmm. and just started to rebuild. But that's where Soap to Hope came from, is that I am going to go do street outreach at night and knock on hotel doors or go into high risk, impacted areas, and just ask people what happened to them.
Wow. So tell us more about that. So what's the soap part?
We hand out hygiene.
You hand out hygiene kits?
Yeah, we hand out basic hygiene kits, and we put a handwritten note in every one of those hygiene kits. And I'm incredible volunteers that make those, because I used to make them myself, but that's a lot of work.
yeah.
But it started off with hygiene. We're like, yeah. I'm just walking around. I'm going to walk around State Street. I'm going to walk around this area. I'm going to walk in hotels. And I'm going to just hand out hygiene.
Why did you think of hygiene? Tell me why.
Because I didn't have basic hygiene as a child. And so I feel like that was the door to
It was the door opener.
Yeah. And
because from what I heard, and maybe I'm wrong in this, is that that was your way in, but you were really there to find out
what happened to him.
Yeah.
Listen
because
to him.
Nobody asked you that over 20 years of addiction. Nobody said, hey, what happened to you?
Yeah, and nobody ever knocked on the other door of a hotel room that I was either trying to hit a vein, trying to sell myself for sex, or being sold for sex, and just nodded and said, hey, I'm an outreach lady this morning if you need hygiene, condoms, any resources. A human that actually is going into an area that's probably not the best area for just anybody, and saying, hey, I love you. Hey, if you don't want to open the door, just know that you're loved. We're out here for the next hour in the parking lot. If you want to come down here, there's no judgment. No, we have safe sex kits. We have harm reduction supplies. We have wound care. We maybe have some used closed items. Maybe we have some water. If you choose to open that door and come down, know that you're going to be loved. Nobody's going to
ask. Are people suspicious? Do they think maybe
you're not? Absolutely not. We have made, we have consistently have knocked on probably the same 14 to 16 hotels doors for 5 years.
And what is
we don't miss a Tuesday. We have never missed a Tuesday in 5 years.
That's impressive.
We now have grown to Monday location, Wednesday mobile, Thursday location, and a Saturday location, because we obviously it's been 5 years. You're hoping to climb the mountain, or you might as well just get off the pot, right? But we got to transition to be an approved harm reduction program, so we get to do syringe exchange, safe. We get to dispose and pick up syringes in areas, or even go in and show hotels and housekeepers hey, some of these hotels, don't go picking up or grabbing stuff, because some of these areas are high risk. That they might have stuck a needle underneath the mattress, or they might be in the trash can. We do a lot of awareness that, and we bring a lot of awareness about exploitation, pimping, trafficking in those areas. And you'd be surprised how many women out there were just like, that's not happening to me. That's my boyfriend. That's my street dad. What are you talking about? I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that. I know.
Yeah.
Hey, let me tell you a little bit about my story.
Are
Same
the
thing.
Women receptive to you?
Oh, yeah. We probably, obviously, it's winter months and people are all over and people opt to go into jail around this time, right, too, or this and that. But we probably meet on the average anywhere from 700 to 900 people a month.
Wow.
And it's just two of us, and we're really small, low-funded. We have a lot of people don't want to support harm reduction in the state of Utah, and a lot of people don't want to believe trafficking or exploitation is happening in the state of Utah.
It's a huge problem everywhere, but it is a problem in the state of Utah.
Yes.
And I am so happy to hear that you're involved in harm reduction. We've got to eliminate this punishment response to people that are struggling with addiction. The punishment doesn't work, but treatment and love and harm reduction
and connection
does.
The truth is that there's it takes about 7 years for a victim of domestic violence to leave that relationship, right? Countless times at the hospital, broken arms, countless times, control or something, police reports. And it's like that out there too, like with addiction or these severe trauma.
When they all go together.
Yeah, it takes a while. So we consistently go in those areas. And we believe in consistency. Everybody asks us, how come you haven't grown here or gone there? And I'm like, what I do right now is build. Everybody knows
You're
where
building
I am
relationships,
Monday.
Yeah.
Everybody knows where I am Tuesday. Everybody knows where I am Wednesday. And I know what I can afford with my budget, right? Like I have, and I'm not going to cause harm by trying to think I'm more or I'm have to be more, right? I love people who use drugs. I love people that are in the high-risk sex trade. I love people that are chronically homeless, untreated mental health. All these people that we meet with, we love them, right? And we want to meet them and not leave them there. But it takes a while for them to build trust with us.
Absolutely.
And it takes a while for them to say, hey, I actually have an untreated STD. Hey, I think I might be pregnant. Or, hey, I can't stop using it. Or, hey, I have no insurance. I don't even know where I would go to get insurance. This has been my entire life. I lived in hotels with my mom, and now she's 23 and living in hotels, right? Like generational familiar trafficking too. You know what I mean? And a lot of that low end pimping, but we just consistently stay there, and we now have through who we are and being a voice, like we get to work with incredible other organizations, incredible treatment programs that support our community. That's like, yes, this person needs to come in on mat. This person needs to be on Suboxone, at least for a little while. They've been out there for 20 years shooting up dope. Like they cannot just cold turkey it.
Right.
Like, or this person has severe trauma. We get to share a little bit of their story. Hey, her treatment plan needs to be different. Mm-hmm. It's not about the substance.
It's not one size fits all.
Yes,
when it comes to recovery.
So we get to be that voice for them. And I send a lot of our survivors or that are fleeing the life, even high risk sex trade, out of state, because we have no level one care for trafficked victims in the state of Utah. John is getting there.
I'm going to ask you a loaded question. I get the question all the time. What do you get out of doing this work? People go, why would you do this? There's got to be something in it for you.
Yeah.
It's my story matters now.
And I love that.
Yeah, my story matters now. For a long time, I was like, I'm never sharing that story. That is not, like, it almost destroyed me.
I was going to say, you tried really hard to not even accept your own story.
Yeah, I didn't.
Share
So
why is sharing your story important to you now?
Because I felt so alone. I totally felt like I hadn't. That's so ridiculous to say now, because now I've met hundreds and thousands of addicts that are in recovery, much less survivors of trafficking and domestic violence and abuse, and parents that are grieving their kid that they've lost, even regardless if it was a car wreck or died at birth. Like, I've met countless people that have my story.
Yeah,
and then I'm not alone anymore, and so it matters more. That I hope that I make someone else not feel alone.
I got to tell you, you are such
a
bright light.
A sociopath?
No, I'm in love with you. I think everything you're doing is wonderful, and your story is so heartbreaking, but you say it so matter of fact and so jovial. I mean, that's what I mean. It's
positive energy. That's what I'm getting.
Yes.
I've done a lot of healing. I am a person that creates healing on purpose, and because my life depends on it. And I have too much. What I've gained here by staying in that, in the middle of this, my 23-year-old, she just had my first granddaughter. I never thought I would be part of a baby's life ever again in my life. Both of those two got taken from me, right? One obviously passed, murdered, whatever. I don't know. I have no idea. Her, because I went to prison, and Kayla was born a chemically dependent. To have a relationship with my 23-year-old and watch her become a mom and my womb trauma come up, right, where I was like, my God, what are we going to do? She's going to lose it. Something traumatic's going to happen. Like, totally projected all my stuff on her. And her still, me giving her my little sassy voice, she's like, no, I'm having this kid. This isn't about you. This is about my life. Mm-hmm. And to be in that room when the birth, and now, like, that little girl, like, it's healing all over for me.
Yeah.
Like, and I get to provide. Like, I get to, like, dude, if I want to spend $500 on my grandkid buying her cool Nikes or Vans, like, I never got that, right? Like, I stole that stuff to just be cool, right? And, like, whatever it is, like, I get all these cool things that come back. I just never thought
it would happen. Recovery is wonderful.
It's,
if somebody's listening and they want to help and donate to Soap to Hope, can they?
Yeah.
How?
We need people to, like, we're running off a prayer and a shoestring. You can get on Soap to Hope's website. We do have a donate button, and it's associated with our accounts, and everything is 501c, and it's a part of our PayPal business account, nonprofit. I don't know what they are, but you can get on Soap to Hope UT. .com. And it's to the number two.
Yeah.
Not. And we have a Facebook page that we love people to follow. We do service projects. We have ways people can donate old used items, hygiene, travel size hygiene. Like, it's not always about the dollar bill. You know, if you want to write handwritten notes with your family as a family fun night.
That would be a great idea.
Like, those notes are the most important thing that goes out there. Do we need money? Do we fly? I'm getting ready to fly two survivors out of state this week, right? Have I worked five jobs to keep Soap to Hope alive? Absolutely. I even worked the door at a nightclub.
Really?
It's just like you were talking about earlier. Yeah. My friend owned it. He knew I was the only person that he knew that wasn't going to steal the money, would know when people are all get him out or trying to sell drugs in his club. Worked the door, trying to supply Soap to Hope. So, because it was my passion, right? Now we've been able to secure a little bit more donors and people involved, which is amazing. I work a full-time job. Like, I have my own full-time job plus run Soap to Hope, and it's night. We believe that we should bridge the gap at night. And especially a lot of our, you know, women that are being, they come out more at night. There's a whole nother belly of beast that comes. There's, you know.
Living that dual life.
Yeah. So we try to do night and bridge that gap and connect them to resources. We want to be a part of the village. We don't want to be the village. So we offer these certain things, harm reduction, street outreach, and victim advocacy. Otherwise, we're transporting, setting up appointments, digital equity, giving them phones, getting them to clinics for testing, HIV. We take them to those places because then that builds a village around that person, because you never know what happens when they get tested, right?
Right.
Hey.
They need some support.
Hey, you're positive for this. And that might be like, hey, I need out. This is my life. So it's been really cool to build. Is Utah still behind on the curve of, like, saying, I have to send a lot of girls out of state that are actually just trauma-informed services, because a lot of people here is, like, the same old saying, like, if you wouldn't have pissed off your husband, you wouldn't have got hit last night. It's like saying, if you weren't in a full-blown addict, you wouldn't have got trafficked. That's not true.
Right.
Absolutely not true. That is not true. And so a lot of the resources here are, you have to identify that you have an SUD or a mental health, and that you're going to go to treatment for this cognitive thing and never work on this piece, you know? So we try to find them a lot of healing programs for survivors. Not that those don't work, but we need to have more options.
More options is always the best.
Yes, more options. And there is some involvement. There's some amazing people right now that are, I don't like saying anti anything. I don't really say anti trafficking, anti this, anti this. I just feel like that's just another, like, negative connotation. There's a lot of people fighting for survivors, organizations for survivors. There's, you know, programs that are starting to shift, taking that in, having different modules, I guess, for people that have severe trauma, that are coming out of these severe trauma places. Just different, you know. I mean, the movement is, survivor movement is, like, survivors are at the table now.
Yeah, and you're creating or being part of that community. And
there's some incredible stuff Utah's doing too.
Dr. Mountain, what do you think about this podcast?
I'm having a blast.
Yeah,
no, I am. I'm loving it. My takeaway, I think, is you mentioned several times, and I could just tell what it meant to you, that you said it a few different times, no one ever asked me what happened to me. And that's a powerful thing, isn't it? When somebody does ask you sincerely, what happened to you? What's going on? Somebody who really wants to listen. And I can tell that's meant a lot in your life. And now you're the voice asking other people what happened to them. And I just think that's beautiful. And that's real love. And I appreciate that you're out there doing that.
And I appreciate your vulnerability to come on here and tell your story and the ownership of it and what you're doing with it and how you're giving back to the community. I think you're an amazing person, and I hope we have you back on the podcast because you are an amazing light.
We need to highlight as much as we can these sorts of organizations that are doing good work like
so
this.
If you
get a small little boots on the ground. I tell people, yeah.
So if you get a chance, check out our Facebook or our website, Soap to Hope. That's SOAP, the number 2, Hope. and you can donate there. You can get together as a family and write thank you letters.
I think that's a great idea.
Or you can read her story, which is The Dark Side of the Moon Child, Memoir, Writings, Poetry, Lost in Silence by January Riggin.
Where can people find that book?
That one, I'm super independent. Published it myself. You would have to email me, or on my Instagram is ManicGypsy01.
I think for every $1,000 donated to Soap to Hope, they could get a book.
Yep.
I just
threw that. That may not be actually the case because I just made that up.
But you can get on, like, even my, I have my, all the setup on my IG account because it is mine. I tried to do something for me because I do a lot. Like, Soap to Hope takes me a lot outside of myself. Yeah. Recovery, you're giving yourself a lot out, or my, you know,
but this
job
was a project for you.
I work in the cannabis industry. And so a lot of it, and I was like, this is going to be mine.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm going to end this silence. Oh. I'm done being silent. And so a lot of the stuff I did talk about is in here, and a lot of stuff, the only thing that nobody could take from me my entire life was a pen and a paper.
Which is crazy because I can imagine you ever being silent.
Oh, now because I'm a little sass.
I love you with all my heart. Well, thank you for stopping by. Project Recovery, in case you forgot, is what, Dr. Matt?
It's a KSL podcast, Casey.
I love her.
Me too.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.